Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Renee. Welcome to Renee's Heart to Heart. Thanks for joining me tonight. I am expecting Israel Kalman to call in tonight and have some more discussions about his program, which is Bullies to Buddies. But before he calls in, I want to open a conversation about the inevitable. And the inevitable is the fact that we all leave this earth at some point in time. Today, I took a very close friend to visit a cousin that she's very, very close to. He's in his 80s. And recently he's been quite ill, and he's been in a veterans hospital. And a couple weeks ago, they had to move him from the VA hospital to a regular hospital. And they are, at this point in time, discussing moving him to hospice. Now, when we got there, he was, he's not on life support, but he is on oxygen. And it makes him a bit more comfortable. He can't take in any food, so they're just giving him fluids. And it was, as most of you, I'm sure, at one time or another have been through this before, a very difficult time. My friend really loves this man, and although I only met him a little bit more than a year ago, he's one of those kind of people who's big and boisterous and friendly and sweet and very funny, and seems to make friends everywhere he goes because he's just so likable and so, I don't know, congenial. And we kind of rousted him. He appeared to be happy to see us. He cannot talk, even though they did take the oxygen off his face. He still doesn't have enough air in his lungs to be able to have any volume to his voice, although he did mouth a few words and let us know that he recognized us and was happy to see us. And we spent, I don't know, probably an hour there with him talking, and we met with some of the hospice people and the doctors and the nurse that's been taking care of him. And, of course, because I'm almost 65, I've been through the loss of my parents, a brother, other friends. Losing someone is not new to me. But it did make me think about a lot of things. And because I'm hoping Izzy will call us tonight and we can talk about some of the things on his agenda and he'll answer some of our questions, I still would like to open a conversation for perhaps tomorrow night, and I will have more information about this. But I'd like to hear from people who have taken the time to write to their family and let their family know what their wishes are. If you do not have a lot of wealth and an estate and things like that, for some reason you kind of skip over those things about how you'd like to leave this earth and what you would prefer to have done. And unless you've already taken care of all that stuff, which I know a lot of people have done that, which is awesome. But if you haven't, what I'm talking about is just letting your loved ones know what your wishes are. And perhaps even final words to your loved ones. I think it would mean a lot to most of us that are left to hear from the people that we lose in a way like that. I've often seen movies and old shows and stuff like that where people leave videos that say, you know, if you're watching this, you know, I'm gone, and, you know, kind of tell a story to somebody. I think that's beautiful. But I'd like to hear from people who have taken steps to do that, to set their loved ones' minds at ease, if for no other reason than to be able to say a coherent goodbye and I love you and that kind of thing. I think it would be beautiful to be able to do that for each other. And I would like to hear if there's other people that have made those kind of arrangements. Many years ago, when I first lost my mother and father, my mom was only 55 when she died. My brother was only 47, and my dad was like 64. So relatively young by today's standards. And I wrote letters then to all four of my kids, telling them that I didn't expect certain things from them because I felt guilty when I lost my parents, that I hadn't maybe done enough or hadn't been there enough or hadn't done everything I should have done. Because if you've never gone through it, it's really kind of a new experience. And we were very untraditional when my parents and my brother died. I did their funerals. We had pretty much Irish celebrations of their life. And that's what I thought they wanted. They never told me that, but that's what I thought they wanted, and that's what we did. So I would like to open some conversation in regard to that. Now, because Izzy hasn't called yet, he might be, a lot of times he's traveling, and I didn't call him today because I was out and about all afternoon and I just didn't call him. So he may be busy and not calling in tonight. So until he does call in, I think we will open, oh, there he is right now. So I'm going to bring in Shelley, and then we'll bring in Izzy, but I'd like all of you to know that perhaps tomorrow night we will open the conversation in regard to saying goodbye. And I'd love to hear from everybody in here how they feel about that and if they have made any arrangements and things like that for when that happens, because like I said, it is inevitable. Hi, Shelley. Hi, Izzy. Welcome aboard.
Hi, Reenie.
Hey,
hi, Reen. Shelley.
Hi, Izzy.
Hi.
I'm, I just, you know, I don't know whether the two of you listen before I see you on my board or not, but I have, I've talked a little bit briefly tonight about when the inevitable happens, which is when we leave this earth. And I spent today with a very good friend and one of her loved ones who is being put in hospice today. And of course, in my history, having lost several of my own loved ones, but also the job that I did at Hippocrates, I sat with many people when they crossed over, whatever it is you believe they do, when they leave this earth and move on. And I'm interested in finding out how many people have written or put something in a will or something so that their loved ones know what they want to have done. So I don't want to talk with Izzy about this unless he has some input for this. I'd rather go to Izzy's forte. But I do want to open that up so that maybe tomorrow night we can talk about that, because it really struck me today, and I guess it made me kind of sad, so I felt like I needed to talk about it. So do either of you have anything that you'd like to say about that? Or shall we leave that for tomorrow night?
As far as I'm concerned, leave it for tomorrow. It's
okay.
Not my area of expertise.
Okay.
Yeah.
How about
yeah.
you, Shelley?
I'll have some input on that tomorrow night, because I got where you were coming from, and I've had some personal experiences with that myself, which I can share also.
Okay. Well, I do think it's one of those kind of things that needs to be talked about, so I think we should. So. But Izzy, tonight, and I hope I'm not putting you on putting on you on the spot, putting you on the spot. But I'd really love for you to talk a little bit more about how you got to where you are and how you came up with the golden rule, and tell us more about yourself and share with us. Because we spent a lot of time with you teaching Shelley and I a little bit on how to handle this and sharing with all of our listeners about how they can do things. But I think it gives us everybody more of a story when somebody is passing on their ideas and their, which are in this case excellent ideas, and I think will save a lot of people a lot of sorrow and a lot of heartache. But I think it would be cool if everybody knew more about you and how you got to where you are. Are you good with that?
Yeah, it's just I'm going to have to keep it concise, otherwise we can spend several hours on it. So I'll try
to get to the main point. Well, and we can do this other times, too, and I can give you more of a heads up. As I said earlier, I had intended to call you today, and this kind of came unexpected, this trip I took today. And when I got home, I had so many things to do. All of a sudden, I looked at the clock, and it was 6:30, and I was like, well, I guess it's a little late to call Izzy. But I think it would be fun to have some nights where you talk about how you got to where you are, because I think that teaches us as well.
One of the things that influenced me, of course, is my religious education. I was brought up pretty much Orthodox Jewish. I went to Jewish religious schools through high school, so I have a pretty solid Jewish educational background. At the end of college, I decided to leave all of the religion. I thought it's all nonsense. I don't believe in God. So for a good few decades, I really was, well, maybe not a few decades, maybe like a decade and a half or two decades, I was very uninvolved with the religion. When about 25 years ago, I got into a little bit more, and little bit by little, I'm more involved again, but I don't see things the way I did when I was, you know, being brought up.
Mm-hmm. Did something happen?
No, it's just a gradual thing, but there are things that happened in recent years that I think made it more obvious. Again, I'm not 100% sure, but I think a God does exist, and we maybe continue after death, and I'm not sure about, but I think there's some pretty good evidence. But anyway, a good part of the religious education is moral education. So I have a strong moral education. Whether or not it's religious, I have a strong moral education. And I learned about the golden rule and loving your neighbor as thyself.
Mm-hmm.
I began college as an engineering major because I loved science. But I ended up hating engineering, and after a couple of years I decided to go into psychology. Because for a number of reasons, I decided I want to learn how to help people psychologically and scientifically. So I got a passion for psychology, and I really wanted to learn how to help people. You know, my interest wasn't research. It was really how to help people. I earned a master's degree in clinical psychology, and after I got that, I moved to Israel. I lived in Israel for a little more than 10 years. But I began working in schools, so I really transformed myself into a school psychologist. But even when I was working in schools in Israel, my interest wasn't testing. Unfortunately, I didn't have to do a lot of testing in Israel as a school psychologist. So I was able to function as a psychologist, do counseling. I spent all my days meeting with people. It was wonderful, and we learned all kinds of different techniques. And one of the things I discovered is that probably the single most frequent complaint of kids is that they're picked on. They're calling me names. They're bothering me. They're picking on me. To me, it was very obvious from my psychological studies why people get picked on. And it's a very simple reason. If you get upset when people pick on you, they're going to keep on picking on you. And if you don't get upset, they'll stop. So I began doing role-playing with kids. I would have them pick on me. And the first time I would get angry, you can't do that to me, you can't say that to me. And, of course, the kids would have a great time. They would laugh their heads off. They'd keep on picking on me. Then I would do it again. I'd have them pick on me, and I wouldn't get upset. It wouldn't bother me. And they got bored very quickly and left me alone. And I began teaching this to whole classes at the same time. I was teaching this to teachers, because there are teachers who are driven crazy by their students. And they're getting angry at the students because they want the students to behave better. They don't realize that when they get angry at the students have a terrific time, and they keep on driving the teacher crazy. So I would teach this to teachers, stop getting angry, don't get upset by the kids, and they would get much better discipline from the kids. I would teach this to parents, because parents are also driven crazy by their students, by their children, I mean. Another thing I learned in psychology early on is that when you get in the middle of two people's conflicts with each other, the conflicts escalate. And it was so obvious. I would watch children fighting, and then their parents would come along to stop them, and the fighting would intensify. But it became obvious they're now fighting over the parents. Each one wants the parents on their side. So I was teaching kids to... I began teaching parents how to get rid of sibling rivalry by not getting upset, by not playing judge between them, and it worked wonderfully. And then, in the meantime, I moved to the United States. I began working, I moved to New York, or back to New York. I began working in schools here. And I was teaching this here, too, with wonderful success. Mm-hmm. And then Columbine happened, and... Columbine made it obvious that just about all of these terrible school shootings are committed by kids who feel like they're being picked on by other kids. And I can understand why kids like that would want to do it. But I saw that what the world plans to do about bullying can possibly work. They're going to do the very thing that causes sibling rivalry, and they're going to do it in schools. We're not going to let kids get away with bothering each other. We're going to have to investigate every incident and complaint. We have to protect children from each other. This is the very thing that causes sibling rivalry at home, and now we're going to do it in schools, as though that's the solution to the problem. I knew it's only going to make it worse. So I began creating my website, and I wrote manuals to teach kids how to stop being picked on. I wrote a manual to teach parents and teachers that they shouldn't play judge between kids, and how to help them reduce bullying without playing judge, while at the same time raising children's emotional maturity and independence. So Columbine really got me involved full time in this problem of bullying. That's it for my bio.
Well, that wasn't very long. You said
it was
you could go on
it was
hours.
Probably 10 minutes. Yeah, but I wanted to keep it, you know, to the point about why I'm involved with bullying.
Well, and you know, the first time you said something about, you know, the sibling rivalry and how you carry that into the schools, even though they're not siblings, they're schoolmates and things like that, that having raised four kids and lived in a household with four siblings, you know, I was shaking my head up and down. Oh, my God, how true is that? And I've often shared a story about my mom's remedy for my sister and I fighting. If I came and tattled on Barbara and said she did something wrong, my mother gave Barbara a nickel. If Barbara went and tattled on me and said I did something wrong, my mother gave me a nickel. And because we'd be so mad at each other, we didn't want the other one to get the nickel, we wouldn't say anything.
Wow, that's brilliant.
So it actually worked, especially when we were quite young. And
your mother was very, very smart.
Yeah, I've laughed about it several times because I never thought of, I knew she was intelligent, but I never thought of her as being real profound. But, of course, everybody says that about their mothers and their fathers, you know, and then all of a sudden you get older and you think, oh, that's why they did that. So But I've shared that many times, and I do think that was a great idea. The day, the first night that you talked, and we got to that part of the conversation about then bringing in the parents, I had visions of, like, baseball games at school and other sports activities where the parents end up. I remember it wasn't very long ago, there was something on the news, well, I guess it was a couple years ago, but there was something on the news about these parents beating the hell out of each other at a baseball game.
Yeah.
Because they were arguing over their kids in the game, and the kids were fine. But the mother, the two fathers went at it like, you know, like it was all about them.
Yeah.
So,
and today's parents get the most, I think in most cases when there's bullying going on, the parents of the children involved are more upset than the kids themselves.
Yeah.
Oh, no, my child is being bullied. This is terrible. The school can't get away with this. The school has to make it stop. The parents often suffer from the problem more than the kids do.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there seems to be, you know, as a parent myself, and I've also said this on the air before, too, and that is the fact that when I realized that there were going to be other adults that didn't think my children were just absolutely adorable, I was mortified. I was like, what do you mean you don't think they're the cutest children that ever walked the face of the earth? You know, I mean, it was like, you're kidding me, right? So the first time I had to deal with a teacher that obviously wasn't real crazy about one of my kids, I was really angry. And I'm not a real angry person. I'm more a diplomat, you know. And but I was so angry because I thought, how could you look at that sweet little face, you know? And I'm thinking to myself, now that I'm older, it makes me laugh when I think about it. But then I was indignant about all of it. And I think that's when things started to go crazy with schools as well. That's when, you know, there was all the upheaval about certain schools where the teachers had a paddle and, you know, it was okay to paddle your kid. And there were teenagers that were like 15 and 16-year-old football players who were being called into the coach's office and getting their butts paddled with a big paddle. And then they stopped all that. And I do think, I never thought it was necessary to lay your hands on anybody to make a point. I'm not, you know, I'm not a slapper or a, you know, that kind of, even a spanker. I would spank if I thought that was so necessary because I'd already said it three or four times when they were really young. But I'm not one of those kind of people who think a SWAT is the answer to everything. So that doesn't make sense to me. But I do believe that a child has to believe that they can be spanked by somebody if they're doing something wrong, especially when they're very young. And I think taking that responsibility away from adults was one of our first mistakes. Even though, very sadly, there's a lot of adults that shouldn't have that responsibility because they don't know what to do with it, there is that side of the issue as well. But still, a child has to know that the teacher's in charge when you're there and mom and dad are in charge when you're home. So, but the fighting between the parents over the kids, I totally understand. So when you are doing something like that, Izzy, when you're dealing with parents and you're trying to help the parents, how do you calm a parent down when the parent is so angry? You know, like I spent a lot of time talking with my son and my daughter-in-law after my grandson got hurt so bad to get them to relax a little bit. My son was very, very, very angry, very angry. And when he'd come in the room, even when Michael was comatose, when Michael was in the induced coma, Mikey, my grandson, would get all fidgety. The blood pressure would go up, the heart rate would go up, just feeling his father's presence in the room because he could feel his father's anger.
Wow.
So how were you able to get the parents to understand that that wasn't the way to go?
Essentially two ways. One is I would show the parents the same things I show children. Mm-hmm. Now, let's say the parents are being driven crazy by their children. They don't know how to get them to stop, but meanwhile, they want the school to make other children stop driving their child crazy. But also, I'd role-play with the parents to teach them how to get along better with their children, that the reason their children keep on picking up or tormenting them is because the parents are getting upset. And I would teach them how, you know, an easier way to get better discipline from the children. And I would explain to the parents the same thing happens in school. Your child is getting upset because they're being picked on. But the reason they get picked on is because they're getting upset. It's fun to pick on, to upset people. Mm-hmm. And then I would also explain the dynamics of sibling rivalry. I have a short speech that I, or a talk, in which I explain step by step what happens when adults get in the middle of their children's fights. And it makes a lot of sense, and the parents go and try what I teach them. And in most cases, it works very nicely.
So actually what you're doing with the parents, of course, is teaching them the same things you're teaching the kids, but just on a little bit different level.
Yeah, for what bothers them, you know, the mm-hmm. parents want their children to behave better, to stop getting them angry. So it's slightly different, but I play the same games, and it's pretty much the same explanations. But let's say you're a parent and you're angry because your child is being picked on by other kids in school, and you're really angry about it, and you're angry at the school. You know, I'll ask the parents, I mean, how many kids do you have? And if they have two or more, I'll ask them, how did the two kids get along with each other? And they'll usually tell me, oh, they fight all the time, the normal sibling rivalry. So I tell them, you know, if you two parents can't get your own two kids to be nice to each other all the time, how is a teacher supposed to make 30 students be nice to each other all the time?
Mm-hmm.
Good point.
Well, that's a great question to put to a parent. Absolutely.
Plus, I'll ask the parent, do you want your child to have to be dependent upon other people to solve their problems? Would you rather your child figure out or learn how to solve their problem by themselves? And any intelligent parent would rather have the children be able to solve their problems on their own than have to be dependent upon other people.
Right, right.
So parents are usually very happy when I teach the kids my techniques for getting along with people and stopping, you know, to be bullied.
And then... what are the dynamics most of the time with the parents that you talk with and the children? What are the ages? Like when you're usually are invited in to help a situation like that? What's your average age area or grade area?
When it comes to sibling rivalry, do you mean, or bullying?
When you're bringing in the parents to help the parents understand and the sibling rivalry and how you teach them the difference between, you know, if they're going to fight with their own brother and sister, how can you expect them to get along with 30 kids in school, and how can you lay that responsibility on the teacher? Huh. What grade is that usually when that makes sense and they seem to grasp that?
It doesn't for all ages, because parents who come to me, they may have children who are toddlers. Maybe they'll have a kid in school, and they're coming to me because of that kid. But when I talk to them, they have children of all ages. And they'll ask me the same things. You know, my three-year-old pounds on my one-year-old, and I can't get him to stop. You know, at all ages, the same dynamics go on. I've had people tell me that they're... older children fight all the time. I try to get them to stop, and they keep on fighting. So it really runs the whole age gamut. I can't give you any specific age that's more common.
Well, I guess the reason I'm asking that question is because all the research I'm doing, it's very, very rare that they're talking about a 17-year-old. It's more prevalent, the major problem with the bully thing is mostly like 13, 14, and 15. And I'm not sure why that is.
When it comes to bullying in school, you're right. Middle mm-hmm. school is usually the worst, but it can be pretty bad from fourth grade and fifth grade also, sometimes third
mm-hmm.
grade.
Mm-hmm.
So middle school is the worst for a couple of reasons. One reason is, especially if it's only a middle school, you're getting kids coming who graduated from a variety of different elementary schools, and they're coming into a new school. So
mm-hmm.
now they have to set up a hierarchy, dominance. Everybody, people want
right.
to be the boss. There's a whole new dynamics because it's kids who haven't been together before. So
mm-hmm.
there's a struggle for dominance, and struggles, of course, aren't pleasant.
Mm-hmm.
So until the people establish their status and relations to each other, it takes a while. And secondly, the hormones are raging.
Mm-hmm.
The kids are now teenagers, and their bodies are growing, and the hormones are going through their bodies, and they're acting wilder than before, and they don't always act too logically. But, you get these kids from different schools, and their hormones are raging, so you got a lot of problems.
Mm-hmm. And then, like, the other thing that I noticed in really, really young grades, like kindergarten and first grade and second grade, when I've been at school with AJ, is, there's bullies in kindergarten. And most of the time, those kids, what I see is that it's more a way of introducing themselves for some reason. It's like, hey, you want to be my friend, but instead of saying, hey, you want to be my friend, they're conking somebody on the back of the head with their ruler, or they're doing something silly like that. And I don't know if, like when AJ comes home and tells me that, I say to them, chances are this person just wants to be your friend, and nobody's ever talked to him about making friends, because maybe, he's always been home with mommy and daddy, and there's no other kids in the family and stuff like that, so he's really not sure how to make friends with you. So the two times that it happened to a degree where AJ was upset, that is indeed what took place. He went in the next day and said, you don't have to hit me if you want my attention. And he's six, AJ is, And the little boy said, I didn't hurt you or something like that. And AJ said, yes, you did. But, if you want to be my friend, you should just be nice to me. So I'm wondering if in a lot of cases, even in middle school, being socially adept is some people are born with it, and some people never have it.
You're right. Some people get along naturally. They develop the instinct for knowing what to do about hostility, and they're confident and they're successful, and other people are less so. But the ones who are less so can be taught how to be more successful.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It really bugs me that adults, including mental health professionals, underestimate children. They think, children can't do this. It's too complex for them to learn how to stop being bullied. Everything they learn in school is more complex than learning how to deal with bullying. Reading is more complex. It takes so long to learn how to read. Math mm-hmm. is so complex. All this is, if you get upset when they pick on you, they're going to keep on doing it to you.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't want to get picked on, you have to learn how to deal with them without getting upset. Treat them like a friend. It's so simple. The video games they play are more complex than this. Well, we think, how can kids learn how to control their feelings? A kid can't control their feelings.
No.
But they can. In fact, children are much better at controlling their feelings than adults are. Children
yep.
can go from upset to happy in a split second. They'll purposely turn on the tears to make the parents feel guilty, or they'll throw mm-hmm. a tantrum, and they'll stop the tantrum in a split second. Kids are much more in control of their feelings than adults are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When I get upset about something,
I
can be
yeah.
upset for days. Really,
yeah.
I can't believe it's something that's upset me for days or a week, and I can't get over it. children get over it so quickly.
I know. They're very resilient, very resilient. And they also seem to take things at face value instead of being as analytical as we are, which is a beautiful thing. It's too bad we all grow out of that, taking things for what they are and try to analyze everything. It's too bad we all get like that.
Yeah.
I think that, I could spend hours with 5 and 6-year-olds, hours. But I wouldn't want to have to be teaching them. I would want to just be enjoying them teaching me, perhaps, is what I'm looking for. Because their easy way of looking at things and everything is not so gray like we do to everything. It's not so, they don't think about repercussions. They don't think about hidden agendas. They don't think about anything than what they're thinking about. It is what it is. And that's a beautiful thing. And it's too bad when they grow out of that. You know, I'm thinking of writing a letter to the producers of SpongeBob SquarePants and talking to them about your idea, Izzy.
And I'd seeing be very if they happy would, if you did that.
Yeah, see if they would do a cartoon show with SpongeBob and Patrick Starr and Squidward and all of the characters, because it's the SpongeBob SquarePants show is an excellent show for young people. It's a cartoon, and it can be very silly, and it can be gross, which all little kids like, but Patrick and SpongeBob are friends, and their friendship means everything. And one of my favorite shows says, SpongeBob says to Patrick, "Patrick, what do you do all day when I'm at work?" And Patrick says, "I wait for you to come home." And I just love that. And SpongeBob works at the restaurant, and working for him, he goes to work happy. He loves to work. He talks about how much he loves what he does. It's all good lessons. It talks about the friendship. It talks about the bad guy is a little plankton guy, but they even like him because he can't help himself. It has really beautiful, beautiful lessons. They teach SpongeBob how to drive, and he's so silly and everything, and he can't drive, and the lady that teaches him how to drive gets so upset when she sees him coming and everything. But that's kind of an eye opener of how frustrating it is unless you're paying attention. And I love it. And it is silly, and it is entertaining for them, and they giggle and they laugh through it, but they still kind of very quietly are being taught a lot of very special social graces.
Yeah. Yep. I only saw the show once, because my children were older when that became popular, so I never watched it. But recently somebody sent me an episode to watch. I think it had something to do with bullying. I don't remember the episode too well. But I thought it was very clever, and I realized that this is really more for adults than for children. What's actually many cartoons.
That's true.
There are jokes that kids won't get. It's full of jokes that adults would appreciate.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. So that's for sure. But again, some of the cartoon shows that are on make the parents look like a couple of idiots. I mean, the parents don't know anything that's going on. The kids get away with everything. They talk to the parents like they're, mentally challenged. And I don't like those shows.
What show are you talking about?
What's the name of that? That's the two boys that they invent things all the time, and I can't remember the name of it.
It's a cartoon for young kids?
Yeah, it's for young kids, and it's on TV all the time. And mom and dad are like dummies.
But that's funny. You have to realize that smart is not funny. Dumb is funny. You were just telling me about SpongeBob SquarePants. He's
mm-hmm.
trying to learn how to drive, and he's not succeeding.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Being smart, being competent doesn't make people laugh. Bad things make people laugh. So the characters in SpongeBob aren't perfect. They all have flaws. And it's the flaws
right.
that make them funny. The mistakes are what we laugh at. So if
mm-hmm.
there's a show in which the parents look like idiots, it's funny because the parents look like idiots.
Yeah, but I feel like that's teaching kids that they can be disrespectful to their parents. You don't feel like that? You just think that they're not seeing it like that, that they're just seeing it as being funny?
I would have to see the show. I would have to see the show and exactly what it does.
Phineas and Ferb. Phineas and Ferb.
The question is when the kids are being rude to their parents, are
right.
they looking, are the kids who are watching it thinking, oh, this is the right way to act or this is the wrong way to act?
Well, that's what I wouldn't know.
That's
and
why
I think
have
they're...
to see the show. I would have to see whether the kids who are being rude to the parents are being presented as positive or they're being presented as negative. Because if they're being presented as negative, then the kids watching are going to learn, well, this is the wrong way to treat our parents. Meanwhile, they enjoy watching it because negativity is funny, not positivity.
Mm-hmm.
Not positivity.
Right, right. Well, I see that point, but I still feel like I said before, I don't know that a 5- and 6-year-old is that analytical to realize that this is just funny. And, of course, that's what I say when they watch that. I don't like the way they treat their mom and dad in this. And AJ will just look at me and say, yeah, I know. My mom would get mad at me if I did that to her. And I said, yeah, she would.
That's
and,
right. So he realizes that this
yeah,
is wrong.
But I don't, he's really bright. I mean, he is mine, and I'm a little prejudiced and everything, but he's really bright.
Yeah, but this is
and
what
I'm not.
Okay. I'm not as big of a critic of popular entertainment as most people in mental health are. I don't think
uh-huh.
it's as dangerous as we think it is. I've written lengthy articles about why entertainment is not really as dangerous as we think. But anyway,
uh-huh.
there's a purpose. If people like something, if they get pleasure out of it, it means it must be fulfilling a biological need. Otherwise, it wouldn't give pleasure. It must have something positive to it. So whenever you see something that people like, you have to ask, what positive biological need is this filling? So let's say there are shows that kids love watching, but the parents look stupid and the kids act like jerks, but they like
mm-hmm.
watching it. It must be fulfilling an important purpose. And there are several purposes. First of all, if adults watch it, if adults watch the show and they see the parents in the show acting like idiots, they're realizing, well, this is the wrong way to behave.
Mm-hmm.
It shows them the comedy show us the wrong way to be.
Mm-hmm.
So the parents will see that. You know, they act like idiots, and then the children are disrespectful to them. So they
mm-hmm.
see, boy, this is kind of like reality. This is what goes on in my house. But let's
mm-hmm.
say from the child's point of view, they like seeing the kid characters in this show being rude to their parents. But let's say the parents are good parents. So the kids will try this with their own parents. They'll be rude to their parents, imitating the kids in the show. What are the parents going to do? So now
wow.
the parents have to see whether they're good parents. Will they respond in a successful way or in an unsuccessful way? So it's
mm-hmm.
giving the parents a chance to practice their skills. If the parents are smart and respond in a successful way, the kids will discover, well, it's not really good to be rude to our parents because it doesn't we come out being the losers here. So they stop
mm-hmm.
doing it. But they'll also appreciate their parents. Thank God my parents are not like the ones in the show.
Yeah, I felt that part of it and thought to myself, part of me got that realization, and I thought, well, maybe, you know, that's kind of a good thing because then kids will be more impressed by their own parents because,
right.
you know, maybe they'll see the difference and think, God, my mother would never, well, like AJ said, you know, my mother would be mad if I did that. Right. So that part I did like. But there's a lot of shows on TV, and I don't put a lot of stock in it either, Izzy. It's not like I'm not one of those people who believe if they play some of the video games that they're going to go out and do something stupid like that. I don't believe that. I think most of the kids in my life that I spend time with are all much brighter than that. But
yeah,
I do think that when they watch something that just very gently teaches you good morals, which is one of my favorite words as well. And I see a real lack of morality today. I see there was an article on one of the shows the other night that I watched because I'm trying to watch all these news shows so I can hear everything that's going on so we can discuss a lot of them. But they were talking about the new contraceptive that you can have the morning after. And now they've changed the law that a child can be 15 years old and go in without a parent's okay or signature or anything and get this morning after pill. And they talked about the fact that they were aware that 11, 12, 13, 14, and 15-year-olds in a lot of cases are sexually active. That made me feel sick to my stomach.
Yeah.
And the fact that now they can take this pill after they've done something that they shouldn't have been doing anyway and make sure. Part of me is grateful because I don't want a 15-year-old having a child.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And this part is easier than thinking of abortion or any of the other ugly things that go along with that. But on the same token, it's like passing out birth control pills in a middle school. It's like you're saying, oh, here, go ahead, sure. I know you're going to anyway, so here you go. And
yeah,
part of me
yeah.
doesn't go along with that because not because you're telling them to go ahead and have sex, but because you're giving them the opportunity to not have any morals.
Yeah, you're making it easy for them to do things that are dangerous.
Well, and that are too, you know, when I realized that I only have one daughter, when I realized that she was becoming intimate with her boyfriend when she was a teenager, I went to her and I said, you don't understand. It's not the act of sex. I said it's the emotions that go with it that you're not ready for. The rest of your body's been ready for a long time. I get that. But your head isn't ready. There are days when I'm not ready for the emotions that go along with sex. And she looked at me real confused. And she goes, Mom, you're making way too much of this. And I said, I don't think I am. And, of course, years later, she said, you're right. You know, she said, it's so confusing. How can we help? Luckily, she has two children, but none of them are girls because she'd probably be nuts. But, I said, it isn't when boys experiment with sex, it seems to be, I don't know, easier on them because it doesn't mean the same to them. But when a girl experiments with sex when she's that young, the emotions are insane. Because it becomes about love and romance and connections and you know, dependability and all the things that women think about quicker than men do. And it's really hard on them. And now when I find this out, and then when I found out that young girls are experimenting with each other first, I'm like, oh, my God, what are we thinking here?
Listen, boys, it might have been changed. It might be changing in recent decades, but when I was growing up, boys experimented with boys also, but not homosexually. It was really you fantasize, you know, that the guy is a girl.
Yeah.
But they're practicing. You know, sex is a very, very interesting and powerful subject.
Yeah. Well, and you're arousal starts when you're a little person.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's like just part of the natural body behavior. So
I remember things from 4 and 5 years old, you know, when I would see, like, pictures of naked women, or I saw a girl and her underwear was torn and you got to see a big chunk of her cheek. Boy, these things, you know, stayed in my mind forever.
Yeah. But again, like, and maybe I'm wrong about this, and I've talked to my own boys about it, and, of course, they just said to me, no, Mom, we don't think about it like that. But I think what hurts me about a girl, and I'm very old-fashioned about this kind of stuff, and I've said to girls that come to me and talk to me about this, and I said this to my own daughter, this is one of the only gifts that it's yours freely to give. So do you give gifts to everybody? I mean, the minute you meet somebody, do you feel like giving them a present? No. I said, then don't be giving this away.
Yeah.
You know, because this is one of your most special presents.
Yeah. And you know, guys love getting it. They'll take it from just about anybody. Mm-hmm. If a guy gets it, it's like a notch on his belt. If a girl mm-hmm. gives it away, it's a notch against her.
Yeah, I know.
You know, girls who sleep around don't get respect from too many people.
That's true. It's true. Although I don't know if that's true anymore. I don't think they think of it like that anymore. Like I said, the morals that are involved there are kind of non-existent.
Yeah. I worked not too long ago with a teenage girl. She was 15 and 16 during the time I was working with her. And she said she doesn't understand it. She'd go out with a boy for a few weeks, and it was wonderful. And then all of a sudden, the guy becomes nasty to her and puts her down and does it in public and humiliates her. Then another boy will start with her, and she'll go out with him for a few weeks. And then the same thing happens. I don't know why they keep doing this to me. But I realized, I asked her after, you know, a while, you know, are you having sex with him? And she said, yeah, usually after the first or second date, you know, they took me out for dinner, I have to have sex with him. So I realized what's going on. This girl got a reputation in school that she's easy.
Mm-hmm.
So the guys, you know, would go out with her, they'd spend a little money on her, they'd have sex, but then they dump her because they don't want to be the guy who's the girlfriend of the boyfriend of the slut.
Yeah.
So they have to
yep.
put her down and make, you know, and, you know, so, you know, to show that they're not going to go out with her. This is a slut.
Mm-hmm.
So I told her, you know, what are you doing? Stop doing this. And then things got better for her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's it. You know, and again, that's why I say it the way I do. It's a special gift, you know. And if you treat it like it's, you know, nothing, then it's nothing.
Yeah.
And
now, I have
it's not
to say,
good for your morale either, you know, for a girl.
The truth is, it's not so great for guys either. I have to say that, you know, until I got married, I loved to have different, you know, women, and I would count, you know, how many I had. But I have to tell you, when I look back on my life, my greatest regrets happened from relationships in which I had casual sex.
Mm-hmm.
I really didn't treat the woman well enough. I just took it for the sex for granted. And I realized I hurt them. And I've never,
yeah.
I can't, you know, lose my guilt over it, because I realize now that I wasn't very considerate to them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Geez, Izzy, I wonder how many men would say that out loud. Not many, I bet.
I don't know. Okay, I never
what
told
do you
this
think,
to my wife, my wife, though.
Well,
yeah.
She'll appreciate it, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
I think that it certainly, if my husband said that to me, that would, I think I would appreciate him saying that to me. So I think that you're not in any trouble. But I think that most men probably have never even given it any thought, is what bothers me more than anything. Maybe more will think about it, you know, if somebody brought it up, you know, maybe other men will think about it now and make that consideration. I know I've had many, many women say that to me, many, many women.
Now,
and,
I'm not saying that if I had my life to live over again, if I wouldn't, you know, try to have sex with, you know, many women, but I would treat them differently. If
yeah.
I would have sex with them, it would be with a completely different attitude.
Uh-huh.
And
well,
I think would
that
do it,
has to do
you know,
with growing
less
up.
Often, less often. I would do it, you know, with less women, but I realize I hurt a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Well, and like I said, that's what's hard on the women. And it's not that the women fall in love with every man that they sleep with either. It's not about that. It's just about the guilt, the emotions, the everything that works to provide the excitement has, you know, has like these long legs that reach into you all over you and make you think about everything. And it's not always so easy for, especially a young girl, and like I said, even sometimes older women, to deal with. And I'm pretty sure that most men, even if they do give it a passing thought, it doesn't stay with them like it does with a girl, especially,
yeah.
like I said, a really, really young girl. And
the whole experience and meaning of sex is much different for a woman than for a man.
Absolutely.
And this is what leads to childbirth. This is the most significant act that a woman can do. And if, you know,
exactly.
if you get pregnant and you don't want it, that's a really tough situation to be in.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that it also means that, you know, it's somewhere in there has to be some kind of caring. Some, you know, even if it's just in the moment caring, there still has to be some kind of caring. Otherwise, the female walks away feeling empty and hurt. You know, I just can't imagine anything else except for, you know, I'm sure there's different personalities in all of us. Somebody posted something on Facebook tonight about how, you know, some of us are really alone and hurt, and this happens to us and that happens to us. And please, if you see somebody like us, you know, take that into consideration. And I wrote on it and I said, you know, some of us are totally different and some of us are totally the same. I, you know, it's kind of a fact of life. We are who we are, and some of us are affected by things and some of us aren't affected by anything. So, but I do think that all of these things enter into some of the unhappiness and some of the pain and the anger that I see out there today because of the lack of morals and because of the lack of waiting till the time is right to do specific things. Because that's one of the things, you know, hurt is what gets you angry faster than anything else, right?
Yeah, anger is a response to pain or fear of pain.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Either hurt or you're afraid you're going to get hurt, so there's an instantaneous step to anger. But the underlying
yeah.
feeling is pain or fear of pain.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well,
look, can I say something about sex and violence in entertainment?
Yes.
I'm actually much more concerned about sex in entertainment than violence. You remember in the 60s and 70s, there was a saying that was, you know, quite well known, you know, make love, not war.
Yeah.
And also, people would say, how come people can watch murders and war on television, but they can't watch sex on television? Why should things be X-rated? Why, you know, isn't lovemaking better to watch than violence? But the answer is no. Watching sex is actually more dangerous than watching violence. Now, I'm not
mm-hmm.
saying I don't like to watch sex. That's a different question, but it's more
right.
dangerous. Let's say when you watch a violent show, after you watch it, do you look for the first person to hit or to stick a knife into or to shoot?
No.
No, you don't do that. When a movie is over, do you see people streaming out of the movie hitting each other because they saw it in the movie?
No. No.
Now, if you watch sex in a movie, what do you feel like doing?
Well, you get horny.
Yeah, you want to go have sex. You want to have sex, and if you can't get real sex, you masturbate. So watching sex makes you want to do it. But watching violence doesn't make you want to do it.
That's an interesting point, Izzy. That's a very, you know, we're going to have to continue this talk because we're out of time. But I think this is a great topic, and I think the kids even need to hear this, and I think it will serve us to talk about this a little bit. So until next time.
That was a great closing comment.
Because you're horny.
It's a very interesting subject, and very few people have seen it this way, but I've written extensively about this on my website, about the why sex is more dangerous than watching violence.
Wow.
We can talk more about it.
It's a really valid point, and I agree with you. And of course, I do think that could be an interesting conversation. So we will talk about it again. But I want to thank both of you again, as usual. Great show, and remind everybody that we will talk about what I started earlier tonight tomorrow. And I want to thank everybody, and good night, and God bless. Good night, you guys. Thanks a lot.
Good night, Renee. Good night, Shelby.
Good night, Izzy. Good night, Renee. Good night, all.
Good night, baby.